And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
It's so classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
All right, everyone, welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis, your host. This is going to be a fun show tonight. And we have two guests coming up tonight. First of all, we have Lee Spiegel. He's going to be talking about a show that's upcoming soon, within a few weeks, we hope. And then after that, I have Rich Hoffman. He was back on 3 years ago. A lot has happened since he was on, and he has a great background. Started when he was extremely young, 13 years old, checking out UFOs, and was actually on the Phil Donahue at age 15, talking UFOs. Isn't that amazing? Anyway, so that's our guest. We have Alejandro Rojas coming up in just a minute with UFO updates. And the blog we have this week from Charles Lear is Trust Me, This Is Science. It's basically about if you're looking into the UFO topic, you know, more or less beware and look out for pseudoscience and try to figure out which is pseudoscience and which is real science, if you can find any real science when it comes to UFOs. So check that blog out. It's on podcastufo.com. We also have a Facebook page, Podcast UFO, and live shows. I think that's how it's titled. And so check that out. There's 22,000 or so people over there and a lot of activity, UFO updates every day. And speaking of updates, we have Alejandro Rojas for UFO updates. Welcome, friend.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. Jeez, that was weird. No intro. I don't know what happened. Strange.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to pretend like that's the way it's supposed to be. On radio, that's the thing, is you pretend like nothing went wrong.
Yeah.
And you just move on.
You're right. You're right. Yeah.
So, that was a great... I really liked how you tried this kind of no intro thing so we could get right into it.
That's right. Yeah. It was a nice... nice little silence. Dead air is wonderful. Yes.
Yeah, a little bit of peace and quiet so we can reflect on what we're doing and gather our thoughts before
That's right.
we get into this heavy topic.
Next week, I'll make sure I have crickets going at the time. But anyway, so how's everything going?
Good. So a lot's gone on. Of course, right, because I wasn't on the show last week. We keep talking about some of these stories that came out in the last week. It feels like we've talked about, but there's no way because we haven't talked in the last week. But it's been an exciting week, of course, although the stories are mostly around the program, Unidentified, you know, America's UFO Investigation. So on the History Channel, that first episode finally came out. You and I, of course, have talked about it since we got an early preview because we're special. We were in special class when we were younger. And we, of course, both like the show. But there's a lot of information. Now, the first episode is mostly information especially our listeners will be familiar with because it included the Nimitz case, some of what was in there, which I think some of our people might not have known about, was, you know, this was the first time we had heard from the female pilot. And
right.
she still mm-hmm. remained anonymous in this. She was blacked out. So that was really interesting to have her go through Nimitz. And also, even though, you know, both you and I have had people on to talk about this and I've written a lot about it, there's so many working parts in the background. It's really confusing. And so I thought they did a really great job of going over Steve Justice's background, Tom DeLonge's, Lou Elizondo's, Chris Mellon, all the major players. I think they did. They all have such incredible histories and credibility that substantiates, you know, what they're talking about. And I thought they did a really good job tackling all of their backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. You know, of course, I'm sure as myself, you probably heard from a lot of people that watched it and, you know, got all kinds of feedback. Someone said there were too many commercials, you know, that you and I were lucky enough not to be able to watch it without commercials. So
I hate commercials, too.
Yeah.
So I get that one.
And then, you know, people were talking, oh, it's just the same stuff rehashed. But I think, you know, like you mentioned, the female pilot, that was really great. And I, you know, there's a lot to that story. And, you know, it's it was I believe it was a really good one to start off with myself.
I agree.
In particular.
Yeah, it was. They had to. You know, it's the one that was out there, and they did offer something new. They did offer the perspective of this, you know, other pilot that we haven't heard from. They also had a couple people come in and analyze the video, and I thought that was really interesting. And you and I both spoke with the producer Anthony Lappe. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's great. You can tell he. And he was right. You know, what he told us in our interviews came out to be true in the show, that they were really just letting things flow. Like he said, he didn't want anybody to do a double take. Like if they screwed up, he was like, no, that's done. You know, we're just recording what happens as it happens. We don't want to seem scripted or script anything at all. And that came across in the show, but it came across very credible. Of course, I feel, you know, we've heard from Lou and Lou's very good at articulating you know, what he feels or what he's trying to do. Chris Mellon, of course, has been incredible. And that's where the news comes in. Getting into the news is that we've got a lot of these people on television. So we've got Chris Mellon on Fox News, CNN, Good Morning America. We've got all of these people, essentially the main players. Well, Lou on all of those. Tom DeLonge on a couple things. Tom DeLonge did a Newsweek opinion piece that was really good. Actually, and I say actually because, of course, we all know Tom could get kind of off into some more odd topics, more speculative topics than the rest of the group. But he really stuck to the topics at hand. That was really good. And then the big news from the week was this New York Times article, which introduced some new pilots that we're going to hear from in future episodes of Unidentified. And these are pilots who were with the Roosevelt, who were involved with UFO incidents that happened in 2014 and 2015. And shockingly, you know, these guys said that they were having these experiences, or at least catching these things on radar for almost daily, that they didn't know what they were. They assumed that perhaps somebody was testing some sort of new drone, you know, kind of a black project type of thing, until they had their own encounter when two of the jets had one of these things. Well, in the story, they make it sound like they almost had a near miss. One of these things was in between them that was cube-shaped with kind of an orb around it. And that's when they really caught their attention. They're like, wow, this is dangerous. This is not good. If this is, you know, obviously it's something physical. This could really put our lives in danger at this point. So that's when they started taking it very seriously. What's really exciting, and of course I'll plug it on my blog, but a lot of people have posted this now, is the history also released to some of us some clips. You probably saw these. Some clips from those Navy pilots. And those were really cool. So I've got those posted at AlejandroTRojas.com, where you could see them. Three separate clips, about a minute or so each, where it's the pilots talking about this incident. But what was revealed in these clips is that these incidents are also the origins of the other two F-18 FLIR videos that we've been questioning since the beginning, the one called Go Fast and the one called Gimbal. We haven't known, you know, where did these things come from? And now we know. We have limited information thus far, except to know that, you know, these pilots are aware of it, have seen the video, do believe that it's something unusual. So that's really exciting that we're going to hear more from this. You know, the other thing that we did get a little bit of information of, and we're getting more, is, of course, this Oregon event I did talk about on the last show with you, the McMinnville event, where David Fravor, one of the other pilots, the wing commander who was on the Nimitz, and he talked about the gimbal video in particular, because he was saying, you know, somebody had asked, well, actually, this was my question. I had asked about, you know, was this a missile or an aircraft? Because there's a lot of the skeptics and debunkers out there who have said that all this was, you know, a rotation. Even our good buddy Mark D'Antonio, I believes this. But Fravor talked about how he feels that's absolutely, there's no way. And he talks about the characteristics of an aircraft. And he makes a great point that an aircraft can't fly like this.
Yeah.
It looks like they are sometimes, but in order to create lift on the wings, they have to be creating, you know, a friction. They've got to bank left or right if they're going to go sideways like this.
Yeah.
He said sometimes the Blue Angels can kind of do these maneuvers for a little while with they do these tricks, but otherwise it's going to fall out of the sky.
Right.
So this was not an aircraft that went like this. And what were the effects we're seeing are not effect from the actual lens of the FLIR camera. So, you know, we now at least we're getting. And I, you know, many of us assume this was the case, that these guys aren't going to come out and say that these videos are unusual for no reason. I mean, their credentials and their are on the line. Their credibility is on the line as well. So when these pilots are coming out and saying, no, you know, this is not something conventional, it's something I've dealt with before and is demonstrating some advanced technology, there's no doubt that they've put a lot of thought towards it to make those determinations and come out and say those things.
That's right. Hey, pardon me. We are out of time because I'm only going to have Leon for about 10 minutes or so until our break. So anyway, thanks so much, Alejandro, and we'll be talking to you next week.
All right. Thanks, man.
All right. Talk to you then. All right. So our next guest needs no introduction. That means I'm not going to introduce him except for say, hello, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Martin. Thanks for that glorious introduction.
That was your whole background, everything. Yeah.
That's called a mini bio. No, I appreciate that. Thank you.
No, you've been on so many times. You've been on so many times, but I guess it would be just we're just so short on time because we only have 10 minutes until we go into break. But so Lee's been in you say it in a quick nutshell, your background for the new listeners, if you would.
Well, I've been investigating, researching this crazy phenomenon called UFOs for 46 years now. Makes me an old-timer in the whole series. Among the things that I've helped to do to forward people's information about this was 1975. I produced for CBS a vinyl documentary record album called UFOs, The Credibility Factor, in which it was the first time that the voices of people who have had encounters, who had strong opinions about UFOs, and these are people in science, in the military, in politics, and had them come together in one voice to basically ask the government, please come clean about UFO information. And from there, I kind of leapfrogged a couple of years later into bringing UFOs to the United Nations in 1978. And then kind of from there, kept moving forward in this, I guess, mission of mine. I spent 8 years on NBC Radio, just doing unexplained phenomena features, more than 1,500 programs about the topic.
Wow.
And more recently, 7 years I spent as the chief UFO writer at the Huffington Post.
That's right.
And as you and many of your listeners know, now I'm still involved with film producer James Fox. We're putting it together. We're in the last throes of an upcoming documentary. And for those who don't know the name of it yet, we started to spill the beans a little bit. This is going to be called The Phenomenon.
Oh, you finally named it. This is name number three, isn't it? But it's going to stick, right? Yeah.
Well, yeah, and one of the reasons why that we've actually chosen that name has to go back to literally 1947, a previously classified military document that's now commonly referred to as the Twining memo.
Mm-hmm.
When flying saucer reports were flourishing in 47, Air Force Lieutenant General Nathan Twining, he was the commander of the Air Material Command, he issued a very eye-opening, but secret at the time, memo to the Army Air Forces. And the subject line of it was the Air Material Command opinion concerning flying discs. And among the things that this very serious memo stated was, and this is a quote from it, quote, "The phenomenon reported is something real and not visionary or fictitious. There are objects approximating the shape of a disc of such size as to appear to be as large as man-made aircraft, unquote. So this memo went on to describe the incredible maneuverability demonstrated by these objects 72 years ago. And these things are still outmaneuvering current global aircraft technology. And so that Twining memo eventually brought about a multi-military investigation known as Project Blue Book. But it was the beginning of the quote where he referred to it as the phenomenon. Both James Fox, I credit James with saying, let's call it the phenomenon, the documentary, because in so many places historically in documents, it's always referred to as the phenomenon. And that just kind of stuck with us. We went, yes, there's our title.
Wow. Simple and good.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's great. It started out for the listener that, because I still get email, I think I got one 2 weeks ago, someone saying, when is 701 coming out? And that was that was the first working title. So what this is morphed into at this time. And it's going to be a smash when it actually comes out. I know it is. With the work that you've described to me and the budget and everything, it's going to be a major movie, and I can't wait for it. And so,
well, we're looking forward to doing it and to talking about it. I'm looking forward more to talking about it on your show. And I'm also happy that you and I will soon be co-radio colleagues on KGRA Digital Broadcasting when I begin my own program called Edge of Reality Radio.
And that's coming up pretty soon. I would think within a few, 2 to 3 weeks or something like that. And you're filling Linda Moulton House time slot on Thursday, which is that 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time? Eastern Time?
That's what we're talking about. All that we're really left to do now is figuring out the technical logistics of my broadcasting the show from New York, back to the KGRA main broadcast studio in Utah, so that it can have a real nice clean signal all across America, and then later across all international borders. So I'm looking forward to this, and I want to get this thing rolling as soon as possible. In fact, I've already outlined the guest list for approximately the first 5 months of my show.
I can't believe that. You told me that the other day. 5 months. And
I'm serious about doing this.
I guess you are. I'm lucky if I have a month ahead. It's not always that an easy thing to do, especially if someone changes at the last minute and you can't get a fill in. And thank you. Last week I announced I didn't have any guests, and you were gracious enough to come on. Let's talk about. I can't believe who your first guest is. Let's talk about a couple of that and a few other guests you have coming up.
Well, my first guest, hopefully, if he still wants to do it and in the mood, because it's been a while since I asked him, is a man named Jacques Ballet. Perhaps you and some of your audience, or all of your audience, have heard of Jacques.
Never heard of him, no. No, that's great. No.
Jacques is not just simply a scientist, an astronomer, astrophysicist. He is like a legend, and not just in UFOs, but in many areas of science. He's done so many things. He was the first scientist decades ago who did a computer mapping of the planet Mars for NASA.
Little things like that people don't know about. Wow. Yeah, he's a multifaceted guy, very interesting. And who's some of your other guests? I know you were going to have Stan Friedman until we lost him. He was looking forward to coming.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. So Stan, very sadly, will not be with us. He's with us, but he's still with us.
Yeah.
On so many areas and so many levels. Going to be talking with as many people in the UFO field as I can. I'm looking for military folks. I'm going to be talking with pilots that haven't done a lot of radio interviews. More politicians, more international figures of people that we haven't heard from. And also especially more scientists, because now we're at a point in time historically where scientists aren't just saying, oh, there's nothing to this whole thing. You know, UFOs are just strange lights or strange inverted weather patterns and things like that. No, it's gone beyond that now, mostly thanks to the New York Times in 2017 and all the stuff that came out with the Pentagon revelations of their top secret UFO studies, and now more recently the whole revelation that the Navy is now creating new guidelines for their pilots and Navy personnel who have had very close encounters. And this is not just something that's just recent. They are now admitting these things have been going on for a very long time. And I've been trying to stress that every time I do some kind of an interview, is that this is not a new thing. It's not an American thing. It's an international phenomenon that we're dealing with. And part of me is kind of curious. I still wonder why the Pentagon or the Navy would suddenly come out and say, yeah, our pilots or military forces have had strange encounters with strange things that we don't understand. Why would they suddenly say that now in history? I don't fully understand that. What purpose will that serve any of us to have this kind of information come out now, like on a more official level, which is what this is talking about? This is what it feels like. I think there's a definite feeling in the air.
I do too.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoever's in charge of what the public is told about UFOs over many decades now, Martin, maybe they're loosening up a little. But for what reason? What purpose will it serve to admit to the citizens of our planet that unexplained aircraft of unknown origin have been operating in our skies for a very long time? So on the new edge of reality radio, I want to explore this a lot and see where it takes us.
That is awesome. Well, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm definitely going to be tuning in. So when that becomes available, I'll make an announcement on this show and make sure that everyone knows when to tune in.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. And I love what you're doing. I'm glad that finally you and I are going to be able to do the same thing now together at the same place.
That's right. Well, competition, right? Isn't that what they call it?
No. That's not really competition.
I know. I'm just teasing.
You know, but the people on KGRA, I don't think anybody is in competition with each other. We just all kind of want to get this information out in the best possible, credible, efficient way.
Yeah. And you had 1,500 shows years ago and some amazing people you spoke to back then. And I'm really, really, I'm truly looking forward to it. And I'm really excited about your show coming up. And so, Lee, we're going to head into break, and I'm going to be breaking on YouTube. Before I do, this is a special note to YouTube listeners. I was hoping to make an announcement for this coming Friday around noontime, and I did not get the 100% confirmation email that I was waiting for. It's going to be a special show, a live stream. You're going to want to see it, so keep an eye on my channel if you're watching on YouTube. Please click subscribe and click the little bell next to the subscribe button. That way you'll get a notification of what I have coming up. But it's about 95% sure that I'm going to have a really, really good show coming up this Friday afternoon. I think it is 12:10 p.m. Eastern time. And also, if you want to get a notification by email, just run over to podcastufo.com. On the sidebar, there is a little email notification thing you can fill out. Lee, thanks so much. And
my pleasure, Martin. Thank you.
All right. Take care, and we'll talk real soon.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right. Everyone hang in there. I'll be right back with Rich Hoffman. All right. Welcome back to the show. Sorry for the extended break. We had a little bit of technology issues, I would say. And speaking of that, our guest, Rich Hoffman, he's an information technology consultant and strategist. He has been with he's been a defense contractor for over 20 years, primarily for the Army Material Command HQ, with a variety of other companies. He's got quite a background. He started when he was extremely young, was on the Phil Donahue show at only 15 years old, I think they called, well, welcome to the show, Rich. Good to have you back.
Hey, it's good to be back with you, Martin. I enjoy your show, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. Good. When someone like you says that, it means a lot to me. Thank you. So I think, didn't they call you a UFO expert? I always love that one, don't you?
I got it. Yeah. Well, the funny thing about it was I had a license plate and it was UFO XPRT and it fit for the back end of my bumper in the car. And the funny part about it was it caused a lot of conversations because I'd be at a gas station and somebody would see it. And they'd say, oh, wow, are you what is that? Or then you get the people that say it's you Foxbert. And I'm going, well, OK, now let me explain that one. But it just starts as a conversation starter. So I just use that for my email and stuff. I said, the hell with it. I'll just use it.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, it's funny.
It's fun.
Yeah. But you have a great background and you've taken the subject seriously as you've, gone through time. And so you've been.
Yeah.
You were actually had cases that you were researching at a very young age, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so let me give you a little bit of an age. I guess sort of when I was 13 years old and I was living in Dayton, Ohio. And so it's right about that time that I found out that there was a project just up the street at Wright-Patterson. My first book that I picked up was the Captain Edward Ruppelt talking about the Project Blue Book. And I'm going like, man, this is just up the road for me. And at that age, it's quite an impression. And it just propelled me big time into it. And I started doing at that time I was doing a lot of like clippings and just getting every book that I could possibly get, every magazine that I could get. Was reading voraciously, and the next thing I know, I was like, somebody asked me up to give a presentation at some sort of an astronomy club in Dayton, and I went up there and did that, and then somebody else heard that I did that, and then the next thing I know, I was getting calls from like Sertoma's clubs and Optimus clubs and everything else wanted me to come, and then next thing I know, churches wanted me to come. and then eventually got word over to the Phil Donahue. And this is before he went up to Chicago and really became famous. So it was when he was just starting in Dayton. So I was like, I guess, an early experiment. But they had heard that I was going around talking all this stuff about UFOs. And so let's just do it. And then the next thing you know is that propelled me even further. So now I'm starting to get phone calls from like people like left and right saying, hey, can you come and check this out? And it's not like I was an investigator at that time, but I eventually moved into like, hey, I got to be able to do that. And then in 1965, there were a slurry of activity and I was going crazy trying to keep up with some of that work on cases. And it just kept building and building over time to the point where if you probably look at my caseload, it's well over 1,000 cases firsthand, like, field investigator work. And it's meeting the rubber on the road, and climbing for the research. And that's what it was about. So I was on the front lines for those. And then eventually I led into me getting into MUFON when it was the Midwest UFO Network. And that was before, a lot. Blue Book was going on up the road. But occasionally I would bump into a Blue Book officer who was doing like the same case or something of that nature. And so we would compare notes or I'd talk with them and then we'd shared information. The next thing I know is they gave me a phone number to call RAPCON for radar approach control. And I could get up and get information about that. And I was connecting with Len Stringfield in Cincinnati and him and I were talking a lot. And then I would bump in occasionally to Hynek, who would be around at the Dayton Engineers Club giving presentations. And I would go and listen to him present. And then, I would bump into Stanton and I would bump into just all these big name people and, in the ufology world. And it was a very exciting time. And anyway, I just I have a very long history with bumping into this stuff, so it's been a joy for me.
Yes, and I'm glad you're at it because you take it seriously. You do a really nice job, and a lot has happened since you and I were talking last. I mean,
oh, a big
lot.
Time.
There's a lot to talk about, and you're part of the Scientific Coalition. What is the full title of that?
Well, we've just changed it. It was the Scientific Coalition for Ufology, and then we've now changed it to the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies.
We wanted
to emphasize that we are studying this stuff.
Yeah,
and that was important. And then the other thing that we learned from, we had a conference here in Huntsville where I live back in mid-March. And at that conference, we had a lot of people that were saying, you know, we're trying to get scientists engaged from the military side. We have none. You know, the UFO term has so much that it's got a stigma even to professors and universities and various other things who want to do more, where you mentioned the UFO and it leads into, you know, all that wacky stuff, right? So much like, you know, Europeans have done it where they've switched over to UAP, we decided to go with unidentified aerospace phenomena, because aerospace is also covering the water as well as the air and space. So it's got all three of those mediums that we can use that one term for: UFOs, USOs, and something else, you know. And so that's we decided to go with that. And scientists that we had and the professors we had and the doctors all agreed that that would be the better way to go.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I should change my show to Podcast UAP.
Well, you know, you do such a great job with it that it doesn't really matter. So, I mean, I'm just telling you that there is a stigma out there that has been keeping conversations a little bit on the quiet side from a lot of people in those scientific worlds. And so we're trying to bring them and make them feel comfortable. And it's easier for them to get this aerospace phenomena thing than it is UFO and come to a conference and maybe get approved by their universities. So there you go.
Now, in the case in the conference you were just speaking about, where you had it in Huntsville there.
Yeah.
I understand. Unfortunately, I didn't go, but some friends went. Randy Nickerson was there. Alejandro was there.
Yeah.
And so from what I understand, the most fascinating part that I got out of the bits and pieces of what I heard about that was that the, in particular, the Tic Tac UFO people are saying it's being beaten to death. You know, we're talking about it too much. But in that in particular, I understand there was someone that did some study on the G-forces of what they were actually visually seeing and seeing on radar, and how impossible they would be for a craft that we know of to stay together, and certainly not any beings inside being able to take those G-forces. Do you have any little tidbits on that in particular that you remember?
Yeah, so let me clarify that Robert Powell got started back when the Paco Chirici, I think that's how you say his name, did a fighter sweep article on the whole Tic Tac encounter. And so Robert got started with it at that time and began collecting evidence and getting a hold of things and trying to document this. And so eventually, then over a period of time, we formed a team of us to begin to take a look at it and to put together and see what we could find out. And obviously we didn't have things like actual radar data. And all we had was the testimony that was coming in. And so we began talking and contacting a lot of the witnesses to that. And so what you could do, and this is where SEU is about. Typically a UFO report might get very minimal treatment scientifically. It might get maybe like a couple pages or something like that. We saw that with MUFON, where we didn't see like lengthy analysis or long term studies of it, and we thought that the better cases deserve that, right? They deserve our attention, and so we said that we're going to spend that time. And so we spent over 2 years putting together this report. And part of the report was to document as much as we could about the case, about what the witnesses said, our attempts at getting FOIA requests. We've got that a whole section on that. We put together a glossary. We put together an analysis based upon a lot of different factors. For example, we talked with the radar people. They would describe objects that would be dropping down from the skies at like 80,000 feet and maybe stopping at 20,000, or even going to sea level and stopping just above the sea level in a matter of seconds. Okay. And then you would take a look at that and say, well, what are the physics involved in that? If you looked at that from a physics standpoint, what could you deduce if you had something with a similar size to the Tic Tac? Let's say an airplane that's weighs a certain weight or has a certain weight to it. And if it were some the acceleration, if you think about if I move from 80,000 feet and I stop, or even 20,000 feet, it doesn't matter. If I'm at 20,000 feet and I go to sea level, and it's a matter of just within less than a second, what is the G-force that would be experienced? What would be the speed of that? How would you accelerate to get to a certain point and then suddenly decelerate to come to a full stop above the water? And the wonderful part about that whole thing is that you can use mathematics and basically the types of things that we already understand and kind of deduce what that would be like. And so he said, let's do that. And so basically you had Peter Reale, who did that and took it on and put together in his papers and in the back of it, in the appendices section, the physics of that are involved in that. And so you find out that like an object that would be going from like roughly 20,000 feet to sea level and stopping in 0.78 seconds or whatever like that would basically have moved at over 100,000 miles per hour or something of that nature. And and the other thing that we did, Martin, was we used also conservative estimates. Instead of it being like 0.78 seconds, let's use it at maybe like 3 seconds. Let's look at it at 6 seconds. And so we did that where we showed in a table kind of format what those different speeds would be, to include what the different the power inputs would have or outputs would have been to have done that. And then you start to look at that and then the G-forces, and you come up with the fact that nobody could survive it. If it were like an aircraft falling from that sky or moving down at that sky, it would basically have disintegrated, and that the G-forces exceed anything human. And so we did that in our plus. We also took a look at it from the standpoint that if you recall in the storyline, when Fravor is making his upward motion and the object is too going from sea level and coming up to about 20,000 feet as it was progressing up in its altitude, the object then leaves and then suddenly ends up very quickly over at the cap point. You hear them mention this combat air patrol, which is a classified point. Of where they are supposed to actually meet when they conduct this red blue experience, this red war fighting kind of thing that they've got.
Yeah.
And so the fact that it did that, and you're able to now measure the speed because that's 60 miles away, and you're able to say, well, let's look at that one, And so then you find out again, it exceeds beyond what we know of in the way of propulsion systems and the G-force that would have been involved, as well as the power that's required. At one point, one of our estimates showed that it would have been equivalent to potentially that of Hoover Dam.
Wow.
And And then you also take a look at the testimony of Commander Slate, and you find out that he talks about there's like a kind of like a mirage-like effect above the Tic Tac or around the Tic Tac. And he talks about that. And so you say, well, okay, is that some sort of a field around it, you know, and what would that be? And that's the kind of details you want from these very credible and very good observers who notice these very small details that help us to understand what might be with the phenomena, I mean, and how it might be performing. And so we need more of that highly, you know, that kind of, and we'd love to be able to have the radar data, but, you know, obviously that's a little bit hard to get since it's apparently not being found or released to us.
I was just thinking that are there other cases that you've been able to study like this, or is it, and can you talk about them where you've come up with some similar things?
Well, you know, I think you might, if you go up to the explorescu.org site that we have, we also did a 162-page paper a number of years ago on the Aguadilla case. And I don't know if you recall that Aguadilla, Puerto Rico incident. But we say that those are the two cases, put together our reports, if you would, and our study of what we saw in the video clips, as well as the and both of them were like infrared or thermal imaging kinds of cameras that were used. The AtFlir is, of course, a little bit different from the Westcam that was in the Aguadilla thing. And so you have to get head smart about the whole thermal kind of like range and find out about the midwave IR, where it is in terms of what it can reveal to you. And that's been a whole new world for us, quite frankly. And now SCU's got a total of about 22 PhDs on board, and we're continuing to now build partnerships with others as well. And we're hoping that we can bring on more of the thermal experts out there. We try to take our studies over to them to get as much as we can to have them peer reviewed. We had this document peer reviewed, and we had the last document looked at by the French, who also came back and pretty much confirmed, for example, that in the Aguadilla case, there was a question about the path, and they confirmed to us that the path was circular, like we had thought that it was. And those things are helpful too. And we just need to have more peer reviewed or more other kinds of like scientific companies or organizations take a look at this, our data, the data, and do the same thing.
Wow. We are ready to go to break. And what I'm going to do here is we're having some issues with Skype. So what we're going to do is I'm going to be actually calling you back on the phone. But for right now, we are heading into break. So hang in, everyone. We'll be right back right after these messages. All right. Welcome back. My guest tonight is Rich Hoffman. And we have him now on the phone. It should be a nice clear signal. Right, Rich, you're there, aren't you?
Well, I'm here. How are you?
Yeah.
Is that any better?
Yeah. Just make sure you hold the phone close, if you would. And so we were basically talking about, you know, the Puerto Rican incident, which there was a lot of. That's the first time I've actually seen like real science and to work, people taking something really seriously. And it almost seems like this seemed to almost open the door for what we're seeing today a little bit. Just the fact that, you know, people are really looking at the subject more seriously. And what is your thoughts on that? I mean, you've seen a lot of change in ever since, you know, last year and a half or so, right?
Oh, dramatically. And, you know, I kind of like, you know, it's one of those things where I look back on my history with this whole thing. Like, for example, you know, are the cases any different from what we had back in the 50s and 60s? And the answer is no. in the sense that we had military cases and we've had, you know, jet pursuits and we've had incursions in our airspace and we've had, you know, all that stuff has pretty much been there. And there's, so it's nothing for me. It's not, you know, my perspective anyway, it's nothing new. We've just had some incredible cases in the past that are not receiving as much attention on the media side. I mean, yeah, they were, they got into National Enquirer or they got into something like that, but you didn't have anything that was really grabbing hold of the attention like it is today. And now you've got, you know, the whole thing is you've got more advanced technology that we have over, I mean, our radar systems have dramatically improved, our capabilities, the aircraft and everything else are fabulous and the top notch. And so the fact that these kinds of systems are detecting these things and they're seeing that they're doing these incredible maneuvers and you have very high level credible pilots and you have the willingness to be able to confront it and put it on to like something like the New York Times. And then now it's out in these videos and you have the credibility of the fact that we found out that there was a program at the Pentagon and you have the lead of that willing to talk about it and help us to get to getting more. And so that's a holistically different flavor than what you had back in Blue Book days and where we were before. And so to me, it's a whole, like a whole other world. And I'm so happy to see that, you know, that they're saying that they're basically saying that, yeah, these things do exist. And oh, by the way, you know, we need to pay attention to them. And oh, by the way, yeah, there might be potential threats and, you know, and they're hanging over our, you know, nukes. Shouldn't we be concerned? You know, should we not be concerned? And so I'm glad to see it's getting that serious attention and it's helping a lot of more scientific people who were, like I call them, going back to Jacques Vallée and Hynek's days, the invisible college, are willing to actually now come out and talk a little bit. And there's more people that are willing to discuss it. So it's, to me, this is exciting times. I am thrilled to friggin' death.
No, I'm totally with you there. I've seen, you know, for just one thing alone, my listenership is greatly picked up with people just now looking into the topic that never had before. And so that's why I kind of dive into everyone's background, if they've been on the show before or not. And, you know, what I've seen, you know, since this whole thing came out and you know, I think it was December 16th or whatever it was, 2017, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Right. Since that time, you know, it just seems to be escalating to where more and more, you know, people are taking it seriously. I'll just tell you a quick situation. I was in, I'm an appraiser. That's my profession. And I was down in Massachusetts. And as I was walking into this house, I saw all these Navy bumper stickers on the back of the car of the people that lived in this house where I was going. And I was in there. And after a while, I said, I had the courage to say, hey, did you hear about the Navy, you know, the new reporting on UFOs, the Navy's actually taking this seriously? And the woman wouldn't stop talking about it. She and her husband's retired, and they thought it was amazing and all that. And then she started telling me about a sighting. And I'm really always very, you know, careful about mentioning the UFO topic when it comes to my profession and all that. But every once in a while, mm-hmm. You know, I feel comfortable enough to talk about it, and this time it was received well, but you never know. But it's a lot more, it just seems a lot easier now than it was when I started the show, for sure.
Yeah, and that's pretty much where I'm at. I mean, it's like when Blue Book was closed, and, you know, they basically had the Condon report and everything else, it seemed like, you know, the credibility of the whole subject went down the toilet, and you just, you know, it's like you can't talk about them much anymore. And then over a period of time, you know, it just got very, very, I mean, more and more, you just couldn't talk about it because it became a joke. I mean, you know, take a look at the tabloids and what they did with it and how they turned it into a joke. And then, you know, you just couldn't even begin to discuss it. And then over a period of time, now you're able to come back and talk about it, and you have that, if you would, that top cover, the fact that there's actually senators and congressional people that are willing to listen and hear this, and the fact that the Navy is and the Air Force are going to be switching to, I mean, the Air Force has not been, I don't think, announced, but they've gone and made changes. And it's not like that they hadn't been, you know, concerned before. It's just that it didn't allow, you know, soldiers and stuff like that are just hesitant to bring it up, you know. And so it now allows them to be a little bit more open. And oh, by the way, I saw something, and, you know, and I said that, and they can talk about it and not be feeling like that they're going to be penalized, if you would. And so that's going to, I think, open up a lot. I hope we can do the same thing for commercial pilots, you know, and, mm-hmm. and that we now get more openness, if we could get that from the FAA and the pilots people, you know, and then we could also get it from other agencies. And then the big question would be, well, who would be the central body to be able to take a look at it and to collect all that? Because it is a global phenomenon, and we need to be concerned about the threats that are over our, you know, over our land just as much as in the water.
That's right.
So I'm hoping that we, and if we see this as a threat, then that opens up doors for where are these things going? What are they doing? And so anyway, that's pretty much my thoughts.
I think I talked about this briefly last time you were on the show, and I still kind of feel the same way, is that mm-hmm. I don't think that the Air Force, whoever it is that is, you know, really looking at this topic, the Pentagon, DOD, whoever it is, that's, I don't think anyone knows any really that much more than any of us out here looking at it. I still think it's a puzzle, and I think that's the reason, the main reason the secrecy has been so long, because how do you defend against something, you know, how do you take care of the skies when you don't know what the heck it is? And you can't assure the people that this is happening, but we don't know what it is. You know, I mean, it wouldn't fly.
I completely agree with you. Right?
Yeah.
We don't have any answers. And, you know, and that's pretty clear. All we know is that there are these craft that are outperforming anything that we've got, and that they seem to be within our airspace and, you know, and water space, you know, our waters as well. And that, why wouldn't we be concerned about that type of thing, especially knowing that other countries are doing the looking, and at the same time that, you know, that we're trying to say that it could be potentially, since we don't know the origin, it could be that somebody else has made greater advancements than we have. And why wouldn't we want to know that? And so I think that's finally coming around, and you know, we don't have the answers, and neither does the belief that the government has the answers per se, in my book. But it also doesn't preclude the fact that we aren't interested and haven't been interested from the standpoint of looking at it from the propulsion systems and how do we build these things. And if you think about us not paying attention to looking into anti-gravity or anything like that, certainly we've done that over this time. That's what the military would do. They would be looking at all the contracting firms and the companies and the Lockheeds and the Boeings at being able to look into that. I don't know if you saw that that the Navy came out that has a couple patents. Are you aware of that patent thing that's going on with the United States? Okay, so there's if you go look up Salvatore Cesar Pais, who is got a number of patents out right now that are looking at building something on the scale of a Tic Tac. And it gets into high energy electromagnetic field generators. It gets into using vacuum states around the object. It uses microwave transmitters. Interesting enough, and it's creating this kind of like a vacuum. And the whole paper is built around the fact that you reduce your inertial mass and your gravitational mass, and you can get to the point where you could do that very kind of thing like the Tic Tac.
You mean the moves?
And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, you can do you can do basically the same kinds of things that the Tic Tac is doing. And, you know, you're not going to suffer the inertial mass. You're going to be reducing your weight. You're going to be able to interact. And so this, these kind of like patents that are out there are in the Navy. And I've been reading them. Hal Puthoff was also cited in that with his polarizable vacuum approach to general relativity. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is science is progressing to the point where we're getting to the point where I think that we may be able to develop those kind of technologies. But you have to realize that these objects have been doing this for a very, very, very long time.
Right.
And so we're going to start to see the potential for us to do that. But it's still in the theoretical world. I mean, I don't know that we're going to hear from Lockheed Martin that they've actually gone out and maybe done this, or if they'll release it to us, or if it's going to remain a top secret type of an effort. But I think that we are actually experimenting in these kinds of things. And why wouldn't we be? I mean, we've had plenty of time looking at this.
Now, what about that theory that you were talking about? Does that address, there's never anyone reporting, the sound barrier being broken when this thing takes off?
Does that address that?
It does address that.
It sure does.
Wow.
It does address that, and so I mean, if I guess what I'm trying to get at is if you look at those five traits that Lou Elizondo talks about in his presentation, this type of an object could, the Navy guy put together is basically probably capable of doing that very thing, and all those types of things. It would be able to function in water as much as in air and as much as in space. So it's transmedium. It would be able to basically maneuver seamlessly without the inertia issues. So you could have conceivably a pilot on the inside of it. I don't know how they would be shielded or whatever like that from the high energy electromagnetic field generators. But he even had in his diagram some sort of shielding to be able to protect somebody. So I mean, we're starting to get there. I think is what I'm trying to get at is that we'll be able to. And then interesting enough that these use microwave transmitters. And when I was doing the landing case that I investigated back in the 70s, where a 70-foot diameter area was completely baked 2 feet in the ground, and all the wheat was gone, there's puff wheat around the perimeter of the 70-foot diameter, there was microwave radiation. So, are they using microwave, transmitters? Is that what's involved here? And does that bake the soil like we're expecting? So you get what I'm saying, right? It's a wonderful time. It's exciting, and I think that science is more going to more and more progress to the point where we're going to be able to look at and build some of these types of things.
Well, the guest I had last week, it was more or less convinced that what we're seeing is time travelers, and in a little tiny way that could fit in that's development. Of something, way in the future, that we're actually seeing. But I thought it was an interesting theory anyway. But as far as, the thing that always comes up when you talk to someone that is, rightly skeptic of how we are being visited, it always comes up with the vast distance that it is to the nearest, star system, the nearest solar system, 4.5 light years.
I wish that they would have been at my conference because we had Dr. Kevin Knuth on. And Devin, if you've ever heard him, his presentation was on relativistic interstellar travel. And you find out that typically, if you look, and this is the interesting thing I think that he did, he looked at the speeds of UFO cases that we have like, for example, the FAA case in Alaska. He looked at the, and that had radar, right? So he looked at the speed there, and he looked at the speed of the Tic Tac, and he looked at the speed from the Bethune case. And he put all these cases together, and he said, these are the speeds that these objects seem to be going, okay? So let me project that out and say, can they go at relativistic speeds that we know of? And the answer was yes. And so then he progresses into the point of talking about, okay, so now if you've got that and you could build a craft that could do that, basically. How would you go out and to go into the interstellar, and how long would it take you to do that? And then you get into the time dilation kind of thing where, you know, as you go towards the speed of light, time slows down for the people on board, right? So it gets to the point where you could go to these, you know, these light speeds, if you would, or near the light speed. And for them to go across the entire universe, it's only a matter of months. All right. So it's in their time, and of course for us back here, it's going to be like, you know, thousands of years or whatever like that. So we keep hearing about the fact, oh, it's going to take you too long, because we're keeping it from the standpoint of our own perspective. Mm-hmm. What you have to do is you look at it that if you get near the speed of light, it's slowing down for them. And for them, and he projected that and showed that these people could literally be on the other side of the galaxy in a matter of days or something of that nature. And he's got that time all planned out. And then what if we were going to build and want to go and go to other extrasolar planets, and we believe that life is? Well, guess what you would do? You would shoot off and you would become nomadic. You would go with a whole bunch of other people with you and basically go to that location, because you know you're not going to be coming back. You're mm-hmm. going to go to that place and you're going to basically inhabit it, right? And then you go and shoot off again to other places from that, maybe that point of reference, knowing that you're not going to come back and stuff like that. So eventually you can get to the point where, because you're only traveling just a matter of months, you're basically there. You go and you settle down and you get squared away, and then you take off to other places. In a very short order, you could be already achieved going to multiple places that are inhabited or potential places where you could live. And so what's the problem here? You know, I mean, you get what I'm saying, right?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so that was his point. And that it was a very dramatic presentation. It did a lot of reframe for a lot of us, because ultimately it's a situation where we, you know, we can do that. We could conceivably do that if we had even just the capabilities of a UFO that they've been demonstrating in those kind of speeds.
That's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with Robbie Graham. And as you probably have noticed, I've been leaving the full unedited shows in for several weeks. Now, I wanted to give you all an idea of what the full show is like, and I would love to never have to edit any shows and give the shows out to everyone. It is costly with the amount of listeners I have, the bandwidth, and the monthly charges through Amazon and all that. So I do want to let everyone know that you can support the show for only $2 or more a month. Or there are one-time payments like $25 per year, and all that's over at podcastufo.com. And so other things, for instance, I have Lou Elizondo coming up. He's going to be for, you know, the supporters only coming up in a show. I'm going to try to add things like that to make it more interesting for people that want to listen to the full shows to get bonus content. So anyway, I really would appreciate the support if you can do it. And some people don't like using PayPal. I understand that. And there are ways around that. If someone wants to email me at martin@podcastufo.com, we can figure that out. Thanks so much for listening. I do appreciate each and every one of you. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.